Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, a program exploring literature, culture, and sometimes film. This episode, we're discussing the writings of Michel de Montaigne, who is considered the inventor of the essay. He wrote on pretty much every subject imaginable, from the basics of the human condition, sadness, friendship, aging, etc., to more niche topics like whether the commander of a place under siege should go out to parley with the leader of the besiegers. His work is also associated with the Stoic school of philosophy and bears some stylistic similarities with the letters of Seneca. For this podcast, we all read a portion, the first book of Montaigne's complete essays, so that's 57 essays. I thought about like doing a smattering of essays over his career, and then just decided not to do that for logistical reasons. Like I it would be harder for everyone to like get, you know, the different essays. So I just thought, well, let's make it easy. I don't know, in retrospect, I don't know whether I should have done that, because I kind of felt like the first book was hit or miss. It's been years and years since I've read this, like almost 20 years now. And I felt, I would say after all that time, I felt much less smitten with Montaigne and the essay form now than I did back then. You know, back then I was really into writing nonfiction, and I thought nonfiction was great. And, you know, I still think nonfiction is great, but I'm just less interested in writing it, and less interested in the kind of art of it, I guess. So I guess starting there, like, you know, I'm kind of coming at it from a different place. So I'm just wondering what your general reactions were. Like, how much did you find valuable or interesting in what you read?
I mean, my reaction was that it felt like the blue cheer of creative nonfiction. Do you know the band?
I'm not.
Do you know the band Blue Cheer?
No, I'm not super familiar.
So the idea, the point, I guess, that I make with that comparison, like Blue Cheer were a late '60s rock band who are generally credited as being the first heavy metal band, right? In the sense that they were the first band, even before the first Black Sabbath album, to have a style that was based around big wall of distorted guitar, right? And so they are of great historical interest in the development of the style, and many people who, you know, go through an intense phase of interest in heavy metal will check out a Blue Cheer album. And everybody I know who has checked out Blue Cheer will go, oh, yeah, it's like historically cool that they invented metal, but it's mostly not that interesting to listen to.
Okay.
The actual, they have the idea for the style, but they don't have the idea to like turn it into a compelling product, right? And that was kind of, to some extent, my reaction to this, right? Like I have enough of a sense of the history of it to know that it's impressive that he was kind of single-handedly, you know, creating the template for a lot of even like very contemporary creative nonfiction writing, and just sort of like expressing himself in this very freewheeling, educated but still informal, right? Free associative almost kind of way. And I have the sense, even though I'm not a devotee of creative nonfiction as a genre the way that you and you know, some other people I went to grad school with were, I have a sense that it's very important in that regard. But a fair amount, at least, of the first book just wasn't stuff I can imagine ever reading for pleasure, really, right? Like, I don't really care whether the opposing general parleys with the troops or whatever it was. A pretty fair amount of it is about military history.
But
anecdotally, mostly, it's just like something like 40% of the mass of it is anecdotes about military history. And I get professionally, from the little bit I know about his biography, I get professionally why that would have been of interest to him. And
he would have thought of himself as a soldier. He was a nobleman, a landed person, but you know, he would have spent his you know, any extra money he would have gotten that he didn't inherit from his estate would have been from, you know, serving his liege lord in as a soldier, right?
He seems very interested in diplomacy. I had the vague idea that he was a diplomat, but that might be pretentious on his part. You know, that might be kind of a self-aggrandizing image. There are interesting perspectives thrown in, right? I think the other thing that I mean, I hate to lead off with criticisms, right? But just, you know, some of it feels very poorly edited. You know, like there's a couple places where he like discovers. I don't know if discover is even the word for it. He kind of feels like he's discovering it, right? There's a couple places where he discovers ideas that are relatively common now, right? And kind of belabors them at length in a somewhat unedited fashion that doesn't really, you know, build in a conventional essay form. And there's some very amusing bits thrown in too, right? Whether they're deliberately amusing or unintentionally, sometimes hard to say, but there's some funny stuff thrown in. But it's just, it's this kind of like mishmash of anecdote and observation and, you know, this Roman general did this to get through this battle. And it's intriguing on paper, but often a bit of a slog.
Right.
I can see why it would be appealing in grad school, though. You know, because it's like when you want something you have to work a little bit to squeeze the juice from, right? Because you like that feeling. And B, when you kind of want that sense of occult knowledge, like, oh, you guys, you read this John McPhee essay in The New Yorker. I know where that came from, right? I can see why that would be. And I'm presenting this in a way that sounds cynical, but I was exactly the same way about, you know, my fields of study in grad school. So I totally understand why if you're at all of an academic bent or just kind of want to like feel like you've got the secret knowledge, like this would be quite enjoyable.
You want to add something or offer a contrasting opinion or whatnot, Chris?
I'm probably right there with Hans. I think that I, you know, pretty quickly what I came to appreciate about it was Hans mentioned Blue Cheer and this being the kind of text of modern essays. There is almost a kind of like, this is, I don't know if this is the right way of putting it, but like a kind of carefree naivete to like cobbling together arguments from generals and philosophers and artists and not needing to, because that it didn't exist. I guess not at the time. Not needing to contextualize those perspectives on the issues that he's writing about, you know, there's no school of theory or you know to kind of structure the attitudes that these different historical figures have brought to these issues. Relative to their own like expertise, you know, are they writing about their own experience? Are they writing about art? You know, are they, and there's a kind of, I don't know. It's like, I'm looking at of the Inequality Amongst Us, essay, and you know, there's, 10, 15 different people who are quoted or pulled in into that piece. And, you know, nowadays I think you would get your hand slapped and you'd have to like justify or contextualize, you know, like the particular things that each, you know, each voice is bringing to this essay. And I think that one of the upshots of that, not having to do that work, because there's no, like, he's not, this is written before all of that infrastructure exists. These are really short, you know, like right. that he yeah. can do this incredible breadth of voices and just kind of like cobble stuff together from Herodotus and Cicero and, you know, Horace and, you know, this or that general and just kind of, you know, blaze. And there is something cool about that. It does feel, it feels kind of free and to the point. And that married with the really kind of conversational, playful, like he's obviously like, you know, there's a really strong, intellectual sort of tone to these right. that is, you know, conversational and, charismatic, I'd say. And, mm-hmm. and the fact that he can move so quickly through these ideas, I think it's pretty cool. But I'm with Hans. Like, I don't know a lot of, because this is so foundational and because it is, so free from everything that's going to come after Montaigne, I think a lot of the stuff that he's coming to is a little bit cliche by modern standards.
Well, yeah, I think that a lot of what he's saying would have been interesting to other intellectuals of his time and are less interesting to us because they've kind of become part of the common pool of knowledge and part of the common, you know, pool of ideas that we accept, I would say. As for the, what you point out, Hans, how he has, you know, if I put on my my Comp 101 teaching hat, you know, I would call all these quotes dropped quotations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because he, I mean, about the only thing he will ever do is tell you who it comes from.
Yeah. Right. You know? Right.
It might just be like a name. Right, you know? Right, right. Like there's nothing that is, a lot of these people, I don't honestly know who he's talking
about. Right. Right. So I'd call these dropped quotations and I did not think they were cool. Maybe I did 20 years ago. Now it had this feeling of something that I guess I would say, like, you know, you used a positive term like breadth, Chris, you know, like it allowed him to like kind of examine a breadth of different ideas and different, concepts within an essay. To me, it made it feel unfocused, I would say. I think it was my reaction. Like, you know, I'm looking at on the inequality among us that you just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it starts
that off, that one's really bad. That one's really, really bad.
It starts off, Plutarch says somewhere that he does not find so great a difference betwixt beast and beast as he does betwixt man and man. And that's the first sentence. So it's like, oh, that's kind of an interesting idea. But then we go down. He's talking about like clothing, you know. You know, I guess that makes sense. Like, sure, like people who have different quality, have different levels of income, will often have different kinds of clothing. But he's not really even talking about economic inequality. He's just talking about like difference in like physical stature right here with the clothing. I'm like, that's what we're doing here. This is, you know, we're not saying anything super interesting, and not that I expect him to say anything about economics other than, oh yeah, slaves are good, it's good to have slaves, you know, like this is written 450 years ago, and you know, he, but I guess what I'm saying is that, like, when I compare this to some other decent essayists, so I know that I'll say someone like David Sedaris, like, and we can roll our eyes at David Sedaris with reason, I think, but at least with David Sedaris, you know, you will get an essay that kind of sticks to the topic in a more focused way, and that was something that I found a little less than enjoyable on this second read through all these years later.
I do think if someone were to say to me, hey, what if there was an author who was like David Sedaris, but 40% of the text was anecdotes about the Napoleonic War, that sounds kind of cool.
You know, that would be, but that'd be okay. Because David's that author who has David Sedaris's voice and sense of ideas, but talked about the Napoleonic Wars, would be probably more concise and probably more focused.
He would have the benefit of 500 years of, in some sense, technological development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, these honestly feel like someone holding court in a late night, you know, drinking session, you know, and just, it's not, you know, I don't know enough of the history to know exactly what Montaigne was seeking to accomplish or judging by the standards of the time. You know, by today's standards, they don't do the work necessary of both moving the needle and then securing the needle where the needle ends up. They feel much more casual right, by today's standards.
Yeah.
I do appreciate the learnedness on display here, right? Like, there is
for
just
sure,
like a way in which he's so... And I guess, I mean, in some ways, right, there are lots of things that he didn't have to learn, right? Like, he didn't have to learn, you know, science in any meaningful way. He didn't have to learn, I think he even talks at one point about his kind of lack of erudition in any particular art. But, you know, he didn't, there are many things that you might have to learn to be kind of like a cultured or educated person now that he didn't really have to. But he still has this great kind of casual command of all these classical sources that is particularly impressive given it's so hard now to kind of like forget the media environment that we live in now and just imagine trying to write something like this where the only means that you have of finding that quotation from Cicero is a wall of books in your library, right? If he even had that. Like, I don't know. I assume he had at least like a physical library, but still, like, it, there is something about that that is, I mean, I think like the formal creativity combined with the breadth of knowledge is, I think, is an artistic and intellectual feat of great, great impressiveness. And I certainly don't want to play that down, you know? And you asked, sure, yeah. one of the questions that you asked, Patrick, was what is not dated about this, right? Which I thought was a smart way to frame it.
Right. I was actually going to move on to that topic.
It's a smart way to frame it because we could just go on and on all day about, you know, what is dated. I think the the freewheelingness that you mentioned, Chris, like that combination, that willingness to just kind of jump wherever his whims of thought take him, that is something that would have felt dated for a long time, but I think to some extent has kind of come back around now, right? Mm-hmm. Like that kind of, at least, you know, when I was taking the forms of nonfiction classes in grad school, I think that kind of willingness to disregard the conventions of form and try to kind of find a personal style that moved between those different modes of thought and analysis, that actually is something that, I mean, maybe, you know, the work that was done in that vein will feel dated again in another 50 years if anybody's, you know, still reading it. But I think that actually, that is, it may be in some sense dated, I suppose, because it went out of fashion, but it is now something that it seems like it's inspirational to a lot of newer writers.
Yeah, I'll say there's something about the freewheeling but very learned interrogation of such foundational concepts that feels like it could be maybe timeless forever. I'm looking at another one. This one is weirdly the one that sticks in my mind as both an example of like, wow, I cannot believe that this is an essay that someone has written, and then also like I kind of am fond of it, but of the uncertainty of our judgment, which is really like just about, well, one person does one thing and they succeed, and another person does that exact same thing and they fail. And, you know, how much does like our judgment actually like impact the outcome, right? Or is it all fortune? And it's so not anything more than that, at least in my reading of it. But it's also like, you know, I read this and I think like this isn't, it's a lot of anecdotes of, you know, who is it? The Carthage, the general,
Hannibal.
Hannibal. Like Hannibal leaves home to invade Rome and that doesn't work out. And then someone else leaves home to invade their enemy and it does, and other anecdotes like that. And and
the way that you boil that down, it just sounds dreadful.
I know, but it's so interesting because I like in my work in life today, it does feel like we have more maybe language and understanding of the relationship between our own agency and deliberateness, but we still suffer from an incredible myopic, delusional failure to grasp how little control we actually have over the things around us.
Yeah.
Such that, you know, I do actually think that this is, it's just an interestingly timeless thing, even if I, at the same time, rationally, I don't think that there's anything profound about it at all. And so I don't know, there's a few other examples of that, but I think that someone could probably, you know, revisit this essay, you know, a few hundred years from now and be like, yeah, you know, it's still something we cannot quite get over. Yeah.
And I think that there is something that's always a little bit heartening about reading documents that are, you know, ancient and come from a kind of foreign world in a way, and seeing little bits of very familiar problems and experiences. Like there's a whole essay that goes on at fairly great length about psyching oneself into impotence through the fear of being impotent. That certainly was far and away the of all the things in this book, probably the thing I enjoyed the most. To a great extent, because it's like, oh yeah, that happened to me, right? Like, it's so much more, it's so much more identifiable than in a personal sense, right? It's something that, as an individual, it's just really, there's something warming about knowing, oh, like, baseline humanity, human experiences, right? Like, these things are probably like our ape-man ancestors in the trees would occasionally psych themselves into being impotent through the fear of impotence, right? And there's something about that, actually, for one thing, that is not dated, right? I think, like, when it is most openly, genuinely human and least classically erudite is maybe when it is the least dated. And I think also maybe it's just always, you know, nice to run into things like that, I think. It makes you feel a little bit more just sort of unity with all humanity, right? Like Osama bin Laden probably, you know, occasionally would psych himself into impotence through the fear of impotence, you know? I don't know why I want to feel warmly united with Osama bin Laden, but the point is, like, even very distant people have underlying commonalities that, you know, if I had to, like, have a conversation at a party with Michel de Montaigne and Osama bin Laden, like, that's a thing we could all have a laugh about and feel a little bit connected despite our radically different backgrounds and viewpoints.
Just all laughing about your soft cocks.
We're just all laughing about our soft cocks, yeah. At a party in hell.
Oh, my God.
I was going to say that that some of the essays felt less dated. The essays that felt less dated seemed to be the ones that had dealt with some kind of specific thing that people just experienced throughout ages, like of sadness, of friendship, of moderation, things like that, of solitude. But I think that would actually be wrong, because like the essay that you're talking about where you know, where we're worried about our impotence. Which one was that?
It has some very innocuous title, like The Power of Delusions or something like that. It's definitely not called Of Impotence.
Right. Sure.
It is...
Of the Power of the Imagination. That's it, right? Am I right?
Okay.
I just love that, because that sounds like it's going to be like a kid's TV show. Right. It sounds like it's going to be an episode of fucking Reading Rainbow. Of the Power of the Imagination. And it sounds like it's going to be some magic school bus shit. And then it's like, if you're worried too hard that you're soft, that your cock is going to be soft, then maybe it will be. And how do you solve that problem?
Well, maybe the general thing to extrapolate is correct then, where those essays that deal with some specific thing that just would seem relevant to anyone do feel less dated.
I mean, I think that things that have to do with the body, right?
Right. Yeah.
Because, like, the kind of basics, and maybe this will change in 50 years for reasons we can't foresee around, like, bionic, you know, implants or something, but, like, the fundamentals of the limits of the body, I mean, those just have a way of transcending culture and transcending technology and transcending context. And, you know, like, it made me think a bit about, in Macbeth, there's the gatekeeper or somebody like that, a night watchman or something, who, like, makes a quip about how he phrases it in very flowery Shakespearean language, but what he's basically saying is that getting drunk makes you want to fuck more, but more likely to not be able to, right?
Right.
And it's such a wonderful kind of, I mean, that whole play is like, well, like any Shakespeare, right? Like it's, most of it is very removed from our day-to-day lives because it's kings murdering each other. But then like you have this one real person who has real person concerns, like saying this identifiable, honest thing. And I think like, yeah, it all, it not, and I'm not saying Macbeth is dated. I mean, I love Macbeth, right? But like the, that you need that little bit of like everyday common experience kind of pushed in there in that way that, I love. And this is very similar to that, I think. And again, like things that are really just connected to day-to-day embodiment, I think. Maybe a lesson for the aspiring essayists among us, right? Like if you want to endure, you're actually better off writing about impotence than about, you know, Donald Trump.
Right, right, sure. Like someone...
Or I'm not, you know, even someone... I mean, not even about current political events, right? But you know, the our feelings about the anxiety of impotence are less likely to change than our feelings about, you know, I don't know, the social position of women, right? Which is something where this is very poorly aged.
Sure, sure, yeah. So let's also kind of think about some of the other nonfiction that we've read on the podcast. We haven't done that much of it. We read Homage to Catalonia not that long ago. We read Road Song by Natalie Cush. We also did an episode that never aired due to technical difficulties on some of Orwell's essays, and that was longer ago. We read a more theoretical book for Cronenberg, right? We read that Jungian psychobabble bullshit book.
We read another unaired episode, but we read that Jeff Dyer book about the film Stalker, which in some ways I feel like actually...
That was unaired? Oh, that was, that's right.
Yeah, because my mom deleted the file off my dad's phone.
Oh, your mom.
My mom. Ugh. But I think in some ways actually Jeff Dyer... Jeff Dyer, even though we haven't really discussed his nonfiction much on the podcast, he is kind of a Montanean figure. In the sense of being an essayist who is very, he kind of ranges over styles and topics in a very free form way and is very unbound by conventions of what a writer, he's very unbound by conventions about how one should expect a writer to be consistent. And I love Jeff Dyer, but.
I do remember not, I mean, I remember... when we did that episode, I thought the film was great, and I remember not thinking that the book was that important. Mm-hmm. And that was coming after we had read Jeff and Venice, Death in Varanasi, which was phenomenal.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Not nonfiction, though. That's a novel. I was going into that thinking that, oh, okay, Jeff Dyer really loved that novel, so I'll probably like this book. And maybe I didn't think it was bad so much as just didn't really do what I wanted it to do, which is kind of the story of my life when it comes to like books and films. Really, like that's so often my reaction. Oh man, this would have been great if it had done the exact thing that my mind said it should have done, right?
Yeah.
We also read some kind of book of philosophy or something, but not like not real like analytical technical philosophy, more like pop culture philosophy that you picked, Chris. What was that?
Yep. I'm blanking.
Yeah. I forget the name of it. But anyway, so we've read a few different nonfiction things. So let's kind of compare the strengths and weaknesses of Montaigne's style to some of this other stuff. Just like to start things off, when I think of Orwell, his essays in particular, I typically think of something of essays that are meant to illustrate like a single distillable idea. So something like Shooting an Elephant, which is ultimate, like it has a cool descriptive story, but is ultimately, you know, like imperialism is horrible and right. bad. Or his essay on the works of Charles Dickens, which ultimately is like, well, Dickens, you know, he felt like, you know, poverty and inequality and things like this are bad, but his only solution was, well, people should be better. People should be nicer people. And that was a while ago, so you may not remember. But that's something that, like, where Orwell seems to my mind, succeed, whereas Montaigne often felt, like you guys said, more freeform, more willing to not necessarily have any distillable statement. Or if there were like distillable statements or lines, they don't necessarily capture the whole thrust or idea of the essay.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I don't know if I can add much to that. I mean, I think that sense of focus is very characteristic of Orwell. I think Orwell also, I mean, it's always hard to assess style in translation, right? But Montaigne just isn't somebody with, you don't read a sentence of Montaigne and go, oh, fuck yeah, that's Montaigne, which you certainly would with Orwell, you know? I mean, and which is, you know, one of the virtues of a great essayist, I think, is style.
Anything to add on that topic, Chris, or no?
No, not really.
Okay, no worries. I do on that. Still on that note, I do want to say that I felt like there were, so I've also read Seneca, who I mentioned in the introduction. So Seneca was a Stoic philosopher, Roman Stoic philosopher. So he's like 4 BC to 60 AD or something like that. I'm not exactly sure of his exact dates, but a lot of how we think about his thought comes from his collected letters that he wrote to a variety of different people, but often to a single friend of his who, you know, lived somewhere in the outer parts of the Roman Empire or whatever. And I recall reading those letters 7 or 8 years ago, thinking, and now revisiting Montaigne, thinking there's a lot of stylistic similarity in that they're free form and less distillable than say Orwell. But I also feel like Seneca does in fact have a greater number of lines that you just remember that feel strong. The one that I still remember from Seneca is He advises us to not make friends so that we will have someone to watch over us when we're ill, someone to comfort us when we're dying, but rather so that we can comfort someone else as they are dying. And that was a line that's like, oh, that's awesome. Like, be a friend not so that you can be comforted, but so that you can be the comforter, which has stuck with me all these years. And I'm not sure anything from there might be some, like, Montaigne seems less memorable to me than Seneca does. Not that you guys would necessarily have an opinion on that, because you guys haven't read Seneca.
But, right. We're no Montaignes here with the. We're no Patrick Montaigne with our deep knowledge of the classics.
I wasn't really trying to be insulting, but I guess it did come out that way. So I apologize.
I was not insulted.
Oh, good.
Because one thing coming out of this is, like, I'm thinking about just the role that these essays play in, like, the educated person of the 1600s, 1700s, and 1800s, I assume. Like, these essays taken all together really, I think, kind of construct at least the illusion of having been exposed to quite a bit of what is important in life. Like is this like the role of Montaigne as, like, the proto-essayist? It also feels like that is in line with these essays serving as, like, a key touchstone in educating people about the world and about different concepts. Or am I completely off base? I really don't know, but I can see, you know, just the copies of the, you know, the volumes of Montaigne's essays as, like, a predecessor to the, you know, encyclopedia on learned men's shelves, who and you know, tutors requiring their students to, you know, read volume one before we meet next and we will discuss. It feels a bit like Montaigne's ability to sort of leap from one subject to the next and be thoughtful about them, and his ability to pull from such a huge corpus of knowledge of, like, you know, the figures who've come before him, that this, you know, it sort of situates itself that way. And I'm wondering, is Cicero like that at all? Like,
Seneca,
not Cicero. Is Seneca like that? Is it like just a huge collection of hot takes?
No, in a bunch
of different directions? Because I think that that's one of the things that seems to me to make Montaigne, like, that's the notable thing that I'm going to take away from Montaigne is, like, right, okay, I could read all the Montaigne essays and I'm going to come away with not in very much useful for me now, but I can imagine feeling armed with a bunch of ideas for a long period of time in our history.
I would actually say that yes. I think I said no at first because I was thinking you were saying something slightly different. But yeah, I would say both Seneca and Montaigne, like, you read both and you're going to come away with things that are not that relevant to you, but that are the hot takes of this one particular dude at this one point in history. The main difference being Seneca has a significantly less broad, a narrower range of texts to draw on, right? Because he's writing 1500 years earlier than Montaigne. So Montaigne is still like immersed in the classics, right? And Seneca would have been immersed in texts that, in many of the same texts like Plato and whatnot, but then there would have been other texts that Montaigne had available to him that Seneca wouldn't. So I guess that seems like the main difference so not necessarily stylistic, just, the breadth of texts that they are able to draw on is narrower in Seneca's for Seneca. But interestingly, you know, Seneca would have lived at a time when every text that had been written and that was of any, like, he wouldn't have been able to read all the little micro communications between, you know, different people in Egypt, but he would have had access to and been able to read all the significant texts that humans had ever written, right? Whereas I don't think that would have been true for Montaigne. Like, there would have been significant things that Montaigne would not have yet had access to.
Right.
So, I mean, not that that's necessarily important. It's just like a dumb history lesson, like a piece of history knowledge that is in my head.
Thank you for sharing it, though. It's good.
I did miss, like, reading this made me miss a bit. You know, there were a fair number of times that I was working my way through this sometimes very amusing, sometimes kind of tedious collection of hundreds of years old French essays. And I would periodically think, God damn it, Patrick, why do I have to read this shit? And then I would think, man, 26-year-old me would have been so pumped to, like, revel in this ancient thought and knowledge. Like, why am I not that person anymore? You know, It periodically made me sad that I was not someone who was encyclopedically voracious enough and ambitious enough and, in a certain way, I suppose, pompous enough to really want to, like, identify myself with this stuff, because there's a value in that, I think, you know, and it made me a bit melancholy for the self that would once have loved the chance to kind of assimilate this into my identity. My voice gets raspier and hoarser as I go.
Speaking, you don't sound impotent.
Impending doom. But anyway, I don't know that really connects to what you were saying, Patrick. It connects to something that you were saying a few minutes ago that we moved away from. But just that may be in my heart what I come away with from this experience.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a feeling that I totally share. You know, like, I think in a very real way, 26-year-old me would have been more excited and more interested in a ton of different texts than 44-year-old me is interested in.
Yeah.
You know, I guess that's just, you know, getting old, right? Like,
sure.
Your tastes get calcified. You have a better idea of what you find interesting, and less flexibility in reaching out to those things that don't immediately strike you as interesting or whatnot. So, you know, I get that. And if it makes you feel any better, like, while I was kind of retaking in these essays, I was like, what was I thinking? when I picked this. I was like, what? Like, it's, I knew you
literally were put in a position, Patrick, of criticizing your own enjoyment in the past. Like, you're like, what was wrong with me that I enjoyed this?
Right.
Rather than, oh, I appreciate the fact that I enjoyed this at that time. Right. It is interesting.
You picked Waterland.
That was more like, oh shit, I think that was a reassessment. Well, that's an interesting juxtaposition, because like what I hear you guys saying is like, I where I come to it from is when something doesn't feel like it substantiates my investment, which is such a cold clinical way of thinking about it, but it honestly is how I find myself thinking about stuff now, where like I have a hard time picking movies to watch because just enjoying something is not always my, is not as often my goal now.
Right.
And that is, I think, a loss. But is that, I feel like,
well, our, I don't know if that's the, a loss.
You don't think so?
Well, I mean, and I guess with movies, we're getting a little bit far afield from the core topic here, right? But I mean, I have the same, I have a version of that too, where it's like, I don't want to watch a movie that I think is just going to be like a fun diversion, mostly, right? Maybe in a social setting I would, but like if it's just, you know, me and one other person and it's like, this is my Friday night, I don't want to put something on that I think will just be an amusing way to pass the time, right? And I think that that is, I don't think that's a loss. I think that's a keener awareness of the value of our time, right?
Right.
And I do think that, I don't think it was poor use of our time to read Montaigne at all, right? Even though like it's not, even though it has its flaws as an aesthetic product, I do think that, you know, it's that calcification you were talking about, Patrick, and that sense of like, okay, you can think of it negatively as calcification, or you can think of it positively as I know what my thing is and I'm going to drill down into my thing, right? You know, like
right.
In the last year, 70% of what I've read has been either Nabokov or Proust. Like essentially the only thing, I only read Nabokov or Proust unless I'm like reading something for the podcast. And that sounds very pretentious, but it's just that happens to be like what I have discovered. I get the most like minute to minute enjoyment from, or the most minute to minute feeling of I have used my time well to indulge in this, right? And I think like having this to kind of push us back into trying to exercise that plasticity is actually very good, is a very good experience and would be.
Oh, absolutely.
And I mean, I think like the, you know, you were talking, well, I brought up Waterland, right? Waterland being a novel we read for the podcast that you and I, Chris, enjoyed dearly when we were 26 and thought was kind of horseshit now. And I think maybe the difference between like Montaigne, I think, still is what we, well, I didn't read Montaigne at 26, but I think Montaigne is what you always thought it was, Patrick. It's just that like we don't quite have the kind of the ambition and the desire to kind of prove ourselves that would be involved in putting the effort in to kind of stretch your brain into a shape that can appreciate Montaigne.
Sure.
But Montaigne is always what I think it is still what you thought it was when, whereas Waterland, I think we felt like we'd been fooled by, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was sawdust, and we had been taught that it was sawdust that had presented itself to us as, you know, diamonds, and we went, oh wow, diamonds, and now
thought you were going to say solid wood.
Oh, that's a better I think plus sawdust and diamonds entendre is the title of a Joanna Newsom song, but it's I'm not using the metaphor in the way that she did there. That was kind of a silly way to say it. But yeah, it was, that's a better way to put it. Like it's sawdust that we thought was solid wood because it is so confident in presenting itself as solid wood, right?
Right.
And it's both good and bad to have the discernment now to go, oh, this is actually just a big pile of sawdust. But Montaigne is not sawdust. I think Montaigne is, you know, Montaigne is it's a certain amount of solid wood arranged in a strange creaky shape, and that was of more interest to us at 26, but it is what it is.
Right. I think that's an excellent take that I'm not gonna like belabor or try to summarize in a better way. I think it's a great way to say, you know, it's a good way to conclude, basically. So I think, Chris, your pick is next. What are you having us delve into?
Well, Hans mentioned Proust, and I was thinking In Search of Lost Time.
Jesus, all seven volumes. You piece
of shit. I'm fucking with you. No.
I'm not saying piece of shit because I think Proust is necessarily bad. I just, what is that? What
it's
is
a lot for In 2 weeks. Search of Lost Time?
That is a lot.
Seven or eight volumes?
Yeah, I think it's thousands of pages. I think
it's seven volumes, each of which is about 500 pages, and paragraph by paragraph, some of the densest shit I have ever read.
Right. Yeah. And I would like I know I've tried to read Swan's Way at least a couple times, and have never like really mentally prepared myself to finish, but. You could do seven volumes is just that's a short fantasy series.
No. I did 2666 and I even fucking forgot to post the last episode. So no, I am down. I would love to have a reason to dig into Proust though. But no, that's not my choice. I am open for someone else picking Swan's Way. Maybe that's a good. You know, not committing to the whole thing.
But like, could it kickstart you into reading it on your own?
Yeah, I'm definitely down for some Proust, but it is not my choice. I looked to see, I don't see that we have done any Kafka.
I don't think so, no.
We haven't.
That seems
reasonable.
Yeah, so I wanted to do the trial.
A trial?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think sure. I might even have that.
I know I've read it a long time ago.
It feels potentially salient. So.
Sure.
Yeah, The Trial by Kafka.
Very good.
All right, listeners, you heard it. We talked about some essays of Montaigne, and Hans left us in a good position with that. So next time we're going to do The Trial by Franz Kafka, which is a classic of absurdist literature, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. All right. Cool. Sweet. Peace out until next time.